Among her many achievements, my guest this week has managed something only one or two broadcasters achieve in any generation, the truly memorable celebrity interview. The Duchess of York, O.J. Simpson, Imelda Marcos, they've all had their hopes and fears, their strengths and their vulnerabilities, exposed by the cheek, charm and persistence of Ruby Wax. It's a very different style from that of the first great celebrity interviewer whom I remember, John Freeman, on Face to Face, but it can yield similarly revealing results. Only Madonna, Ruby Wax has written, kept her mask intact. But while many have revealed themselves to Ruby, she says this of herself in her book, How Do You Want Me? I realised I'd been living my life like some gun went off at a starting line and I'd been driving at turbo speeds with no brakes and a few breakdowns, only to avoid looking directly at what I was doing. Ruby has had a good deal of counselling and therapy in the course of her life, and that leads us to our great life this week, the life she's chosen, Carl Gustav Jung.
A great change of our psychological attitude is imminent. That is certain.
Why?
Because we need more psychology. We need more understanding of human nature, because the only real danger that exists is man himself. He is the great danger. And we are pitifully unaware of it. We know nothing of man. Far too little.
And that was, you could just hear the voice questioning in the background, John Freeman interviewing Jung. Ruby, if you had to go for a founding father of psychoanalysis, Jung's a more challenging choice than, say, Freud, an elusive, almost mystical figure, less clinician than prophet, poet or priest. Of all the people you could have chosen in this field, why Jung?
First of all, I couldn't do Freudian analysis because I don't believe the base of all our repression is sexual. Mm. So I studied it a long time ago at Berkeley University. Then I had a Jungian analysis for a long time. Of course, I don't remember anything because I've suppressed it. But certainly the idea that we have a soul, I don't believe in a God outside, and that we're constantly changing. You know, my son does physics, and it's interesting we've come to this time where we know there is no solid point. We're always changing, we're always transforming, and we're part of everything. Jung was kind of hip to this, and so he understood that the mission in our life is to keep transforming.
Did that spark when you first studied him at Berkeley, or did you have to go through a big chunk of life before you began to understand it?
Well, it's one thing knowing something intellectually, and it's another thing living the experience. Obviously, the first half of your life, you're driven by the ego. And my ego was riper than anybody else's I met. So I wanted to study psychology, but I had to nurse a pretty big ego. So when I came to England to study drama, which I was going to glue together with psychotherapy, because I was going to do psychodrama, suddenly I got famous. And that's the most addictive thing of all, you know, to suddenly believe in your own myth. So I developed this persona that just got firmer and firmer. And then I was just as obnoxious as some of my guests. But it was so gradual, I didn't realize it. So you live the first half of your life creating a mask. And now it's the second half of my life, and I'm unpeeling it. And that's exactly what Jung said. That's how we should live.
As you say, you came here to England to
develop my ego. Well, and study
the
Shakespeare.
The CV says the Royal Shakespeare Company.
No,
well,
it was to massage my ego.
You made a very successful career writing and performing comedy, but recently you've been taking qualifications in psychotherapy. A couple of years ago, you kind of disappeared. Mm. At least something was going on beneath our radars, but we didn't know about it. So what's been happening to you and why?
Well, Jung was right. You know, eventually something rises up from the dark swamp of your psyche. And I couldn't do the type of TV I was doing anymore. So I thought I better start learning who I really am, because I don't want to wake up at 80 and think, what have I missed? So I thought I'll go back to school, because I never finished at Berkeley. I'll get my degree. And also I'll study neuroscience, because P.S., that's the new zeitgeist in town. And I think Jung would have loved what I just learned.
Dylan Thomas, once getting up halfway through dinner and leaving, said, somebody's boring me here and I think it's me. did you begin to bore yourself?
Oh, I became intolerable. I mean, in the beginning, I truly loved my documentaries because the motivation was curiosity, and that's still healthy, you know, to meet the head wizard of the Ku Klux Klan and use his costume and say quietly to myself, I bet I'm the first Jew that ever wore this. It was so dangerous. And that was my idea of a good time. Then celebrity came in, and it started to be a contest of whose ego was bigger, and I used to win. And I got stuck. So I thought I have to go back and really find out what I was really interested in. So I'm quite turned on by how your brain works rather than what Sharon Stone is wearing under her skirt.
To help take us through what you're really interested in, to help guide us through Jung's life and, more importantly, his theoretical work, we have with us Andrew Samuels. Andrew is Professor of Analytical Psychology at Essex University. He's a leading Jungian analyst and an author of many books on Jung. Andrew, I imagine we're going to be focusing more on ideas in this programme and less on events and people. But let's start with Jung's upbringing and his parents. His mother in particular seems to have played an extremely important role.
I think starting with the mother is absolutely right, because everybody usually starts with Freud. And long before Jung had heard of Freud, he was writing stuff, as a student in his 20s, that really does tell us a lot about what he was going to get into. But to go back to his mother, she was into spirits, into invisible forces. She was a non-rational, intuitive person. She was also an ordinary mother. And this divide so fascinated Jung that he said that she had a number one personality, which is the everyday, the ordinary one, and a number two, which is this in touch with the mysterious dynamics of nature. There are two other things, I think, that you need to say if you're thinking about where Jung gets it from. One is he got a lot of it from women. Most of his relationships, intimate sexual relationships, led to huge theoretical breakthroughs. And I think he wrote about this, although in a coded way. And the second place he got things from was living in a sick society or a sick culture, because Europe, before the First World War, was in the most awful pickle in every conceivable way, and the First World War, far from cleansing it, just accentuated it. So a lot of what Jung has to say needs to be understood as a kind of general therapy for a world that's in trouble, and that's true right now.
We could use him now.
I mean, in that clip with John Freeman, what he's saying is that the human destructiveness, evil, what he called the shadow...
Is it us?
We need to find a way into Jungian ideas, and actually there are not too many big words that you need to grapple with Jung, but let's start with one of them, the concept of individuation. Explain.
Things happen to you, and if you're open to them, it deepens your sense of who you are and your experience of life. You drop your persona, which is another one of the words of Jung, meaning your mask, and nobody becomes a true self, okay? The world is just too complex and messy to talk about a true self, but you become closer to something like that, and that's what you're talking about.
Well, and also you find the uniqueness you had as a kid. You know, in a playground, everybody's different, then everybody grows up to be a suit, or a celebrity, or a mother, and as you get older and older, people become rigid, unless they really do this self-realization. And I love this expression, people at a certain age, probably mine, either turn into wine or vinegar. And this is where the road divides, but you got to work at it. This doesn't just happen.
Well, as a shrink, I would say people turn into both, and my second point would be who says. Nevertheless, you're right on the button.
I say.
Yeah,
here we go.
I don't know.
But
you're right on the button that there is something that happens to people at a certain age when they just don't want to go on with the show anymore. And when that happens, they get ill.
Or they break down.
Yeah, well, that's what I mean. Yeah. They get into terrible emotional difficulties, and let us hope they get through it. But it's something that isn't often said about mental and emotional illness. You get through it, and you change, and you have a contribution to make thereafter.
Oh, much more. I mean, I only am interested in people that have had a real crisis, because you don't evolve unless you face the dark force.
What do you mean by the dark force, Ruby? What is it?
Well, there is within all of us, and I don't know why. I'd like to know this. You know, when God put it, or whoever put us together, why did he give us this? Why couldn't we just be like cats and have a nice day and lick ourselves? But I guess you'll take that out. We have a dark force. We have something that we're repressing. Obviously, probably when we were kids, not all the experiences were heavenly. So we sit on this stuff, and unless it comes out, it bites you in the face anyway. So you really have to face your demons.
One of the things I like about the drift of Jungian thought is that it allows us as human beings to progress and develop all through our lives. It's a refreshing antidote, at least for someone of my age, to the idea that basically we've learned everything we're going to learn by the time we're about 20 or 21. At the start of the programme, we heard part of an interview Jung recorded with John Freeman in 1959, which was just 2 years before his death. He was well into his 80s. Here are his thoughts on old age.
I have treated many old people, and it's quite interesting to watch what the unconscious is doing with the fact that it is apparently threatened with a complete end. It disregards it. So I think it is better to live on, to look forward to the next day, as if he had to spend centuries. Then he lives properly. But when he is afraid, when he doesn't look forward and he looks back, he gets stiff and he dies before his time. But when he is living on, looking forward to the great adventure that is ahead, then he lives.
I think that's fantastic. You know, that he acknowledges that it's fear that kills us. It's our own fear. But if you keep your, when you want to call it, heart, or you keep your mind open, then everything becomes an adventure. I love that he says that.
He says that fear is the opposite of love.
Mm.
So you picked up on something absolutely critical. However, I actually have a criticism of Jung here, and I want to share it with you. I think he idealizes. I think Jung was old from the word go. He was called Methuselah by his student fraternity.
Right.
Okay. So I think he was a kind of preternaturally old soul. And therefore, I think there are bits of what a child is like, what a kind of trickstery, playful child is like, that maybe Jung doesn't give enough stress to. You know, it's all very heavy. You read the collected works, he breaks into 19 different languages, most of them dead languages. You know, it's all very heavy. And this may be one reason why it's so difficult.
Well, I think of him as an old hippie.
Yeah, well, certainly.
You know, when he goes and travels and makes those mandalas, you know, the only person I knew who made a mandala was somebody smoking dope.
Mm-hmm.
You know, some of it is too way out for me.
Yeah, but I don't think he really writes enough about the spirit of youth.
You see, I hate this idea that old age is actually an upward progress. It isn't. I prefer to be young. I loved youth. I see old age as a degeneration.
Yeah.
I love enthusiasm. I love the way you can believe in things when you're young. I love the way you think you'll never die when you're young. I love the quickness, the intelligence of youth. I love the physical prowess of youth. And everything about old age to me is simply a falling back from that. And Jung is no comfort to me.
I agree with you, but I think if we live talking about World War II, that will actually isolate you and start to cut off, you know, a lot of your life force. Whereas there are people that are so evolved. I mean, I have to say, I miss my youth and I miss being gorgeous, you know, and I miss doing the perky television shows I did. On the other hand, I can feel something else kicking in, which is a real peace or a way to know how to manage my brain and choices that I can make now that I'm not at the mercy of the excitement of hormones driving me. I still have hormones, but you know, there is something that I feel like more whole or more unique, and that's that individuation. And I really like the fact that I'm entering that. I didn't have that when I was young. As speedy as I was, I felt no pleasure.
You're listening to Great Lives on Radio 4 with Matthew Paris. My guest this week is Ruby Wax, and with the help of our expert witness, Professor Andrew Samuels, we're discussing the life and work of Carl Gustav Jung. Let's take a slight diversion now and hear a little of Ruby's work.
How did you get the role in Baywatch? What was the audition like?
Bouncing around. Who could do the Baywatch bounce the best?
What is the Baywatch bounce? Show me the Baywatch bounce.
You have to do it with
Teach me, oh great master. Of course I will. I'm trying to get a job on this gig. You speak, or do you just have breasts and therefore you are?
That's it.
You are a
this
breast?
This show, yes.
Do you hope someday to use your mouth?
I'm
in the middle of a conversation. What's wrong with you?
They don't want you.
The woman's talking about her acting.
They don't want you in the show.
Sorry.
That was my producer, Clive, who is such a good sidekick.
Ruby, when you were interviewing celebrities, I think you were taking a Jungian approach. I know you now think that's part of your life you want to move on from, but you were speaking truths.
If I like them, and I did like her, then I'm not ashamed of that at all. We were teasing each other, and to me, that's the highest form of flattery. When it was somebody like a father figure, like Donald Trump or Don King, I was really sticking the knife in. And then they'd get very angry, and I'd go, what? I was just being adorable. Well, I wasn't. I was getting daddy back.
You really didn't like your father, did you?
He was too much for me. You know, he really didn't like women. So every time I interviewed a man, and especially a strong man, I would feel quite intimidated, and it was war. Well, I'm over that now. I really like strong men, and I work with very strong men.
And in a Jungian sense, you are one.
Oh, I am one. You're not kidding. I'm more male than female.
Well, more, I don't know. More's you. But Jung had this idea, as you know, that inside a woman there's something that it was called absurdly masculine, the animus, and inside a man something called equally absurdly feminine,
anima.
The anima.
Yeah.
Exactly. Okay. This is a fantastically contemporary approach to gender. and to the behaviour and roles of women and men.
Yeah.
Because what it does is it says that a woman who says she's more a man than a woman is still a woman.
Sure.
She's not a case. She's not a problem. She's not a harpy. She's not anything she need worry about. And actually, this is very much there in the Jungian approach to gender and to sex roles. And clinically, it's absolutely brilliant. We're not talking enough, Matthew, about the fact that this guy really was a therapist. In your intro, you said he isn't known as one. That's true, but he really was one. He was a psychiatrist and a very good intuitive therapist who helped a hell of a lot of people. Yeah. And these ideas about the bits of you that are different from the person you seem to be, you're more man than woman, and you seem to be a woman. This stuff is red hot clinically because it liberates people. They don't have to listen anymore to the dictates of society as much as they did. They can listen to that inner voice we've been talking about.
Well, it's cutting edge because it has an exact resonance with neuroscience.
Yes.
You know, he was right. I have testosterone. There's no question.
Yeah.
We know that now. So why shouldn't I have more male? And I'll bet you if you could weigh it up, which you can't, I probably have more than I have estrogen. I mean, it could come down to that.
But enough of us, ladies and gentlemen. Let's talk about Jung for a minute.
My testosterone. I was very interested.
You said you wanted to get away from your ego, Ruby, so I'm taking us away.
Well, you're talking to my ego. You know, the other bit isn't really in the room. Well,
could I talk to your ego about Jung himself?
Okay.
I want to get an impression of the physical presence of the man, because he was a huge charmer, wasn't he, Andrew?
Yes, he referred to himself as the Bull of Zurich once, but that was in the context of death. He said, when I'm lying in my coffin, will they remember that I was once called the Bull of Zurich? He definitely liked women and learned a lot from women.
He was Swiss.
He was a Swiss bourgeois psychiatrist married to a wealthy woman living in a pretty plush villa on the shore of Lake Zurich.
Married well.
He married...
Really
he,
well.
He married wealth.
Yeah.
You know, this question of Emma Jung's wealth was really big problem, I think. I remember once saying to Jung's grandson, and I made a slip, I said, you know, Emma was the richest woman in Switzerland, which is not true. She was rich, but not the richest woman in Switzerland. And he was mortally offended at the very idea that I would bring up the fact that Jung had a wealthy wife.
Really?
Yeah, because it's a very sensitive matter that Jung didn't really have to earn a living. I mean, Emma looked after him in the house. Tony Wolf and other people looked after him in the soul and sexual areas.
Who was Tony Wolf?
Tony, Antonia Wolf, was a different kind of woman. She didn't have children. She was intellectually much more penetrative than Emma, and she took care of Jung's, I think, soul needs and also probably his sexual needs as well.
What was Emma there for?
Well, Emma provided
dusting?
Him... Well. As you know, Jung was a crazy guy in lots of ways. He had a creative illness. He had a near breakdown. She was the rock. Yeah.
He also had the best of both worlds, didn't he?
Yeah, you're not kidding.
Yes, he did. And what's interesting is how they all worked at it. This was a very conscious attempt to find an individuation pattern for relationship.
I'm getting a little bit skeptical.
Yeah, me too.
Here, I mean,
you're scaring me now.
You're cheating on your wife, and your explanation is you're finding an individuation pattern for your relationship. You're
cheating means she doesn't know, right?
Well, you're abusing your wife.
Because if we all go for our whims, I'd have, you know, 150 men for everything I needed. I wouldn't call that individuation. You know, individuation is the real thing. It's not to do with other people. It's to do with your own personal... becoming evolved.
I think it's worth using this word in context other than an individual person's life or predicament, because it's an approach that is nonconformist and non-judgmental. And I think the world needs it very much.
I do too, but sorry, I feel sorry for Emma. Maybe she's celebrated every day Antonia got him off her back. But it sounds quite selfish to me. That's not being evolved.
I think that the three of them worked very hard at it in a very uptight world, at a very uptight moment in history, to live uniquely individual lives.
Oh, uptight's a lovely word to use of people who think that you're behaving badly, but maybe you're behaving badly and it's your problem and not their problem that they're uptight. Emma did talk about divorcing him at one time.
Well, there you go. I'm swinging toward you.
Emma apparently did at one point think about divorce, but didn't in the end. And by the time Jung...
What about her individuation?
By the time Jung reached the old age that we're talking about, say by the time of the Freeman interview, he was reconciled to the fact that Emma had been absolutely central in his life.
Well, his sex drive
had
probably lowered by then.
Yeah, well, I think Tony Wolf was dead by then, actually. But I mean,
he lost his mistress.
But the point I'm making is that sure, he was flawed, but actually, if all the stuff you're talking about means anything, it's got to apply to more than one selfish, self-centered, potentially selfish and self-centered individual. It's about an approach to life.
You're not acknowledging the collective consciousness, which is what keeps us moral. Otherwise, we'd just be killing each other, eating each other, and looting each other.
Oh, but I think it goes like this.
We've got to have some moral connection.
I think it goes like this. Jung saw that bourgeois morality was fake. Now, if you don't like that he had two women, you have to come to terms with what it does to your idealism in relation to Jung. For me, there are other things that he did in his political views and so forth that are far worse than a triangle into which three adults entered voluntarily and worked consciously to keep going.
Okay. Then why did she want to divorce him? But we're going in circles.
We've actually ended up with Ruby prosecuting the person whom she's chosen as her great life.
Have I done something wrong?
No, not at all. I mean, just fascinating.
He's not your father, you know.
No, I'm so sorry, Daddy. I'm so sorry.
Listen, we've done something that I think has never been done in a program about
flip somebody
Jung so
around.
Far. No, we've.
I don't like Jung at all.
We've discussed Jung. You don't like him.
No, I'm being funny.
We've managed to discuss Jung for more than 20 minutes without mentioning the F word, Freud. I don't think we can completely avoid Freud, and I would like you in one paragraph, Freud. Andrew, to give us a potted history of the relationship with Freud.
There are very different variations on it, that it was a homoerotic love affair that went wrong, that it was
a father-son
relationship that went wrong, that it was a Jewish, non-Jewish relationship that went wrong, that it was a scientific versus spiritualistic relationship that went wrong. The only thing everybody agrees on is that it went wrong, and it went very, very badly wrong, and psychology has been wrecked by it. What a tragedy for the therapists and their clients and the contribution therapy might make to the world that these two things have got split. So it has to be neuroscience or the soul. Why make that choice? These two things really belong together.
This is how, many years later, Jung recalled one of their final meetings. I greeted him warmly and asked about his family, Freud, that is. That's when he looked at me in utter astonishment and asked why I was working up this humanity. But I welcomed him warmly on purpose to show that I had no personal resistances, but merely represented another scientific opinion. He, on the other hand, thought that I wished for his death. He always accused me of personal motives that didn't exist at all. Something always had to be wrong, but that was pure projection on his part. This relationship has seriously broken down.
Seriously broken down.
Freud fainted a couple times because of something Jung did, didn't he?
And then Jung said that when Freud came round, he was looking up at him as a child looks up as a father. Actually, it's kind of interesting.
So they reversed roles.
Well, isn't that what always happens in a way?
Yeah. The break between Freud and Jung, which was final and very bitter, was followed by Jung's own breakdown. Is that the right word, Andrew?
I think he had a kind of creative illness. That's the phrase that gets used over and over again. I don't think he was psychotic. I think he went into a very strange place. But I do think that the losing your mentor is very, very difficult.
I think he went a little psychotic. You know, he started having visions and dreams while he was awake and following these kind of stories down into to read it. He sounds like a psychopath.
See, this is very interesting because we're doing it again in a way. We're doing the same thing
I want Matthew to like me, so I'm ganging up against you. Yeah. I mean, that's what's going on.
Yeah, but I'm used to that kind of thing.
You can take it. That's your profession.
It's my profession.
Does Jung's breakdown, or whatever we call it, creative experience, fit with your own experience, Ruby? Did something like that happen
to
you?
No, I don't. My creativity dried up.
Yeah.
You know, that's the first thing to go, is suddenly, you know, I can really write, I can really flow. And when you start to go under, that's taken from you. And then eventually choice is taken from you, and eventually you don't even know on a menu what to order.
How did it start? How did you start?
I don't know. I mean, the reason I'm so interested in neuroscience now is because I don't want it to ever happen again. And so I'd like to feel the triggers. I'd like to feel when the cortisol starts turning on. Because actually, if you're really attuned to yourself, and this is why I think the day of the shrink might be coming to an end, is where we learn to self-regulate. Is to actually experience where are those tiny triggers that I won't have to pay £100 a week for somebody else. How would he know?
Can you, looking back on it, see where the
triggers
were? Totally.
I can see where the tsunami started, yeah.
Where?
Look, it would be a phrase that would mean nothing to you. But because I wasn't aware of it, then the next little failure or the next slight, and eventually the floodgates open and you could just look at me the wrong way. And meanwhile, a chemical is building in my head. That's what's happening. It's not that I wanted to have sex with my father. That's not in your head. There isn't a little guy with a megaphone. What's actually happening is I'm building a chemical bank.
But can you give me any example? You say it would mean nothing to me. Well, try, see if it does.
All right, I had to give an award once to another documentary maker, okay? I had to stand on stage and give a BAFTA to somebody. I should have said no thank you. Instead, I stood there and gave it to somebody, and the resentment in me was almost off the Richter scale. Right? I probably did something similar later on. Probably one of my shows, my ratings went to 4 million instead of 15. And so I heard my father saying, you see, you screwed up again. You see, you screwed up again. And eventually, the levels of in my brain got so heavy, it washed over any sense or any rationality. So I did break. And that means either you acknowledge the breakdown and you say, well, this is what I am now, and end up in pantomime at 87. Or you say, okay, now I'm going to go back to what I really was interested in, which is psychology. So I was forced, because of my career being sort of taken from me, to reinvent myself. And 4 years later, I go, phew, I'm glad I did that, because I know about neuroscience, and that's much more interesting in a dinner table than talking about what Bette Midler looks like up close.
Ruby, Jungians will soon be marking the 50th anniversary of Jung's death. He's probably not as fashionable now as he was in the 1960s. What do you think Jung and Jungian thought means now in 2009?
I think as a society we're quite ill. And it might be connected to this Jungian idea that we've been suppressing our dark side. So now is an opportunity to look in and say, where am I? I don't want to just get to the end and I accrued a certain amount of money. You know, I'd really like to live life, whatever that means. And I don't think any of us have been discussing it since I was born.
Would you have reached these conclusions without Carl Gustav Jung, do you think?
Yeah, sure I would.
Are you then saying that he's really just been a convenient body round which to wrap thoughts that you were already having?
Yes.
He's not changed you himself.
Look, I can't remember what therapy does. You know, where does it begin? Where does it end? I've had so many years of it. They probably sculpted my brain. I'm sure they did. That many hours, something's going to give. Maybe it did. I don't know. The court is out whether psychotherapy helped me or I just became evolved on my own.
You know, Jung said, show me a normal person and I'll cure him for you. One of his incredible achievements was to destabilize what we think is normal and what we think is abnormal.
You've been listening to Great Lives. Thank you to my guest, Ruby Wax, and to our expert witness, Professor Andrew Samuels, for helping me explore the life and work of one of the great lives in psychiatric medicine, that of Carl Gustav Jung.